On this 18th day of July, 2006, we are reading from Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 1, observing the armies on the battlefield. And we're reading text number 36. Many of you have page 57, but in any case, it's first chapter, text 36. Papam eva shrihid asman hatvaitan atatayinaha tasman narhavayam huntum dhatarashtran sabhandavan svajanam hikatam hotva sukina syama marava. Arjuna says, sin will overcome us if we slay such aggressors. Therefore, it is not proper for us to kill the sons of Dhritarashtra and our friends. What should we gain, O Krishna, husband of the goddess of fortune? And how could we be happy by killing our own kinsmen? Purport. According to the Vedic injunctions, there are six kinds of aggressors. One, a poison giver. Two, one who sets fire to the house. Three, one who attacks with deadly weapons. Four, one who plunders riches. Five, one who occupies another's land. And six, one who kidnaps a wife. Such aggressors are at once to be killed, and no sin is incurred by killing such aggressors. Such killing of aggressors is quite befitting any ordinary man, but Arjuna was not an ordinary person. He was saintly by character, and therefore he wanted to deal with them in saintliness, the aggressors. This kind of saintliness, however, is not for a kshatriya. Although a responsible man in the administration of a state is required to be saintly, he should not be cowardly. For example, Lord Ram was so saintly that people even now are anxious to live in the kingdom of Lord Ram, Ram Raja. But Lord Ram never showed any cowardice. Ravana was an aggressor against Ram because Ravana kidnapped Ram's wife, Sita. But Lord Ram gave him sufficient lessons unparalleled in the history of the world. In Arjuna's case, however, one should consider the special type of aggressors, namely his own grandfather, own teacher, friends, sons, grandsons, etc. Because of them, Arjuna thought that he should not take the severe steps necessary against ordinary aggressors. Besides that, saintly persons are advised to forgive. Such injunctions for saintly persons are more important than any political emergency. Arjuna considered that rather than kill his own kinsmen for political reasons, it would be better to forgive them on grounds of religion and saintly behavior. He did not, therefore, consider such killing profitable simply for the matter of temporary bodily happiness. After all, kingdoms and pleasures derived therefrom are not permanent, so why should he risk his life and eternal salvation by killing his own kinsmen? Arjuna's addressing of Krishna as Madhava, or the husband of the goddess of fortune, is also significant in this connection. He wanted to point out to Krishna that as the husband of the goddess of fortune, he, Krishna, should not induce Arjuna to take up a matter which would ultimately bring about misfortune. Krishna, however, never brings misfortune to anyone, to say nothing of his devotees. Om Gyanatamarandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmidatam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him. So, Arjuna is representing all of us. Arjuna is concerned that he do the right thing. We should also be concerned that we do the right thing. That's good, but just make sure it's low. Is it on the lowest? Okay, that's fine. Thank you. So I spoke about this before, but we should consider this question, that the Bhagavad Gita is spoken to convince us about what real dharma is and convince us about the importance of performing dharma and avoiding adharma. Dharma is a word that is now part of the English language. But the real import of this word is often not understood in the popular mind. So once again, dharma, derives from the root word. Every Sanskrit word has a root, a very simple root, and the root of dharma is dhri, D-H-R-I. This word dhri means to support or hold up. For instance, we have in this temple their lordship, Sri Sri Radha Giridhari. Giri means hill and dhari means he who holds up. You can see the relationship between the word dhari and dhri. Dhari means one who holds up. So you can see in each corner of this building, of this room, you have a little sculpture of Krishna holding up a hill. So there's a whole pastime behind that. So dhari means to hold up. The word dharma means that which is the essential nature of something which sustains its existence. For instance, everything has a dharma. The dharma of salt is to be salty. If you have a little white powder that's not salty, you know it's not salt. The dharma of sugar is to be sweet. The dharma of a floor is to support you. If you walk on something and you fall through, then you can say it's a lousy floor or it's really not performing its proper dharma, right? So you go that everything has a certain essential nature. So we also have a certain essential nature as spirit souls, as living entities, we call them. And that essential nature revolves around the fact that we're always serving something. In other words, we are under the control or under the influence of a higher force. We may not realize it, but if you think a little bit about it, you can see that it's true. For instance, we are now under the strictures of the particular body that we're in. Each of us is a certain age. We have a certain level of health. We have a certain longevity, and we can't really do much about it. I mean, we can do something to maintain our health, but basically, we're controlled by this body. We can't fly like the birds. We have to deal with this body. We all know when you go through school, you take an IQ test or you take an aptitude test, you're going to be placed in a certain class or a certain level, and then you have to deal with that. You have to accept that. That's what you've got. Deal with the cards that you set. So, and as we go through life, when you get a job, you have to, serve the boss, you have to please, otherwise you're out. Right? We don't like it very much, but it's a fact. So in so many ways, we are under control in this world, in this life. And we should see it that this is a form of service. We have to serve the needs of the body, we have to serve the needs of our children, our spouse, and so forth. So the question is, since that is the dharma of the soul, is that we must serve something. We're serving our senses. We're serving a higher force. How can we direct that? Because we have free will. Unlike the animals and lower beings, which work mostly by instinct, we have free will that can be guided by our intelligence. So we can decide, to a large degree, what we will serve and how we should direct that sense of service to our ultimate good and the ultimate good of everyone. This is what Bhagavad Gita is all about. Arjuna, he is hesitating to fight this battle. Now, this battle is the result of a long history. The fact is that these six, we read about the six aggressors, right? In this purport, Prabhupada points out that according to Vedic injunction, this is Manu Samhita. Manu Samhita is like the log book for mankind. The word manu is what the word man is and human is derived from. So each age has a manu, and they write a book called the Manu Samhita. Samhita means a collection of hymns. And they contain laws by which we can live. And if we live according to those laws, then we can prosper and we can make our life successful. So part of this is this Manu Samhita sets these injunctions that certain aggressors can be killed, should be punished immediately. One who gives a poison, one who sets fire to the house, one who attacks with deadly weapons, etc. There's six here. The Pandavas, Arjuna and his four brothers, these five Pandavas, who were righteous sons of the King Pandu and who really deserved the kingdom, but it had been usurped by their rivals, the Kurus. The Kurus had done all of these to them. They had humiliated their wife. They had tried to kill him by poisoning, by fire. They had certainly usurped the kingdom. So there was supreme justification for fighting this war. It wasn't wrong. It was a righteous war, just like we have in our history. You know, to really find the most righteous war, we go back to World War II, right? So yes, that was a righteous war. Hitler was a definite bad guy. He was trying to take over the world. He was evil through and through, and it was good that we fought him. And if we had lived at that time, then we would be right in joining up and fighting the good fight. So similarly, Arjun and his brothers were on the side of right here. But he hesitated to fight because it was complicated. On the other side wasn't just, you know, evildoers, but they were friends. It was just like the Civil War. Any of you who have studied the Civil War in America, I haven't studied in a long time, but I remember, it split families. You know, you'd have people in the South, and some of them were from the North, and there were families fighting each other. It was extremely painful when you get this civil war. So this was kind of what this was. It was an internecine battle. And so Arjun was moved because he's a Vaishnava, because he's a devotee of God. He has a soft heart. He's sensitive. He's empathetic, in addition to being righteous. And he said, oh, why should I fight for this kingdom, which is, after all, a material thing? When to gain it, I'm going to have to kill my relatives. My teacher was on the other side, Dronacharya, who trained him in military art. The great-grandfather, Bhishma, and so many cousin brothers. You see, I'd rather not have the kingdom. You know. And so this was his dilemma. On one side, he knew that Krishna wanted him to fight because Krishna had a motive completely non-material. He simply wanted to reinstate Dharma in the world. Real religiousness in the form of Yudhishthir, Arjun's older brother, so that righteousness would be done and real religion would flourish in the kingdom. So this is the dilemma of Arjun, and we find that this sense of service. Arjun was: should I serve Krishna? Should I serve his desire, or should I serve my own desire to see my relatives alive? And the heck with the kingdom. Kingdom he didn't care about. You know, he had those two pulls, if you will. And so we also have that at all times. We have the pull of what we want to do immediately, you know, or what's to our own personal benefit. And then we have the pull, or you have the influence of what is right. Now sometimes we don't feel the dilemma. But the purpose of the Bhagavad Gita is to give us that other alternative very strongly, to see that, yes, we have two influences, and we have to decide which one we shall obey. So the influence of our own interest, or even our extended interest, is explained in the Bhagavad Gita. It's analyzed that as souls living in this world, we are in what is called a conditioned state. Means that we really don't know what our own best interest is as living entities, as spirit. And therefore, we act on the basis of matter, means the impulses of the body or the extensions of the body. This is what Arjun is doing. He's acting especially on what he considers the welfare of his relatives. Those are extensions of the body. There's billions of people in the world, but we identify a few as our kith and kin, right? Why? There's some blood relationship or some marriage relationship or some friendship there. It's a circle. It may be 100 people, 200 people. And everyone else outside that circle, we don't wish them ill, but if something happens to them, it doesn't affect us so much, right? So, but that's, why is it that we have that circle? Because there's a relationship of the body. We're born in the same place, we associate with them, and the mind also. This is a subtle body. And others, we don't have the relationship. There are a million people, you know, billion people in China. I don't know their names. I don't know who they are. You know, we share the same planet together, but there's no intimate relationship. There's not much feeling, you know. And so, yes, they're dying. It's a bad thing, you know, of hunger or this disease or that disease. Maybe give some charity. But if my cousin dies, my brother, my mother dies of a disease or gets sick, then there's a tremendous feeling there. So this is all based on physical relationship. And the first lesson of the Bhagavad Gita is that we have to transcend that consciousness, that frame of reference, which is based on the body. And so Krishna will teach here's what happens here is very dramatic, that Arjun, he's arguing here, he's making a whole case how he will not fight the battle. But then he surrenders to Krishna. Krishna is the supreme guru. He's the supreme teacher. And he's the supreme lord. And so he is teaching Arjuna. First he has a conversation with him on the basis of one kshatriya to another. But then when Arjuna says, he comes to the critical point, which we should also come to, I don't know. I cannot figure out the ultimate good for myself. Because there's so many ideas coming, one after another. I don't have any absolute standard. I need to find a source of the truth, with a capital T. What is really best for me as a spirit, as a soul? And so Arjuna surrenders. And this verse, which will come up, we can quote repeatedly. Karpanya dosho pahata sabhava prichami tvam dharma sambuddha cheta. You may have heard and noticed that in that verse, the word dharma is there. So he says, due to being confused by this weakness, and for kshatriya, weakness is the greatest threat, you know. But now he's dropped his bow, he's trembling, he's crying. This is not the proper behavior for a kshatriya. A kshatriya has to be very forthright and heroic. But Arjuna can't help himself. He says, Karpanya dosho pahata sobhava prichami tvam. I'm overwhelmed by this miserly weakness and confusion. Please tell me what's for certain what's best for me. This is the whole key. Prichami tvam dharma samudacheta. Dharma samudacheta means I'm confused about what real dharma is for me. I may think something is right and act on that basis, but I'm not certain. Maybe I'm going down the wrong path, you see. So I don't know. So in this state of confusion, you say, Yakshreyaksyan nishchitam bruhitanme. Please tell me for certain what is best for me. And not only what is best for me, but how I can attain that. Now I am a soul surrendered unto you, shishyasteham shadimantam papannam, I surrender. So Arjuna's point of surrender there is key. He's saying, please instruct me from this higher platform. And that instruction, if received in the right way, can give us all auspiciousness. So what is the first instruction that Krishna gives? Who can remember in general? Padmavati? We've been around the...
Can't you?
No.
don't think of all these things that are favorable.
No. in the second chapter, text 11, he starts his instructions to Arjuna. Has anyone read that part yet? It has to do with the soul. Remember? Huh? You're not the body, basically. He says, Ashochanam Ashochastram. Pragya Varak Shabasha say. He more or less chastised him a little bit. He says, you're speaking all these learned words because Arjuna was referring to the Vedas. You know, he was saying, he was making these arguments that the Vedas say if I engage in this battle, I will commit sin. You see, a real person who's sensitive to Dharma doesn't want to commit any sin because sin is the source of suffering. Sin means actions against the laws of God and the laws of nature. Okay. In America, you know, what is this global warming thing all about? You know, what is the inconvenient truth? Okay. We all know the inconvenient truth. Okay. It's Al Gore's got together all these data about what's happening in the environment. Well, my goodness, you know, we're pouring forth all these tons of carbon dioxide in the air and it's having a deleterious effect and it's changing the climate and can be disastrous effects. So this is not absolute dharma, but it is an awareness that actions that we do have serious consequences. We're violating the laws of nature. You know, we're putting too much carbon dioxide in the air. And as we do it, it'll heat up the environment, and before long, the seas will rise, all kinds of things will happen. So there's all kinds of laws. You know, everyone knows you got to wash your hands, right, before you eat. If you don't do it, you may get sick. It's a law of nature. There's germs down there. They're all trying to get us, right? So there's a million things like that. But there's also higher laws that we're not aware of. And these higher laws, we have to know. If we're ignorant of the law, that's no excuse. A child puts his hand in the fire. He doesn't know. Still burns. He still gets a blister. Fire doesn't forgive, right? The mother has to teach the child. Don't put your hand in the fire. He learns the truth. So these laws, these truths, Arjuna was speaking on the basis of one interpretation, but Krishna says, no, you're a fool. He says, you're speaking learned words, but actually you're foolish because you're lamenting for what is not lamentable. And that is this body. The soul is the real self. So Ashochanava, those who are wise lament neither for the living nor for the dead. Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings. This is revolutionary. Birth is an illusion. Death is an illusion. We live eternally. The first lesson of Krishna, the second thing he says, is that you'll never die. And you were never born. So now we have to go on a different platform, because Arjun was dealing with, you know, the bodies of his friends and relatives. Now you have to... We are transmigrating from one body to another, even in this body. Think about it. Yeah, see if we can get some prasad. I'm sorry, there won't be any darshan until 8:15. Is that okay? Would you like a little prasadam? You're welcome to stay for class. Pull up a chair. We're speaking on Bhagavad Gita. Can we get a chair? Get a chair. Prabhu, immediately get a chair for the lady. If she wants to sit down. Come on. Thanks. Yeah, come on. Hare Krishna. We can get four chairs. Would you like, if you'd like to stay? Hare Krishna. Krishna is speaking and he's saying, even in this body, this is like a revelation. Think about it now. All of us here were once 8 years old. Isn't it true?
Yes.
And if you think hard back to there, if you can remember some things about when you were eight, right? It's a whole different world at that time, right? We were much more innocent, right? We just wanted to play, right? We maybe were in third grade or something when you're eight. So we had a different body, right? All of us were much shorter, probably. Most of us, I assume. Maybe not you. We had a different mind, right? There's the gross body and the subtle body also. The subtle body is inside. It's more important. The subtle body is the mind and the intelligence and the sense of self. This is what is much more permanent than the gross body. Gross body just lives maybe 80, 90, 100 years max. The subtle body can live for thousands and millions of years because it really is what is carrying the soul. So as we grow up, right? Now we have an 8-year-old body. Then after 5 years, we have a 13-year-old body. We all know there's a lot of differences between that 13-year-old body and the 5-year-old and the 8-year-old body. But we're the same person, isn't it? We have the same name. Mother calls us the same. We have the same family. We're the same person. We're the same at 13, 18, 23, 28. The same person is there. The body's changing, but the same person is there. So what is it that's the same about me? My mind has changed. I got all different ideas and different desires. My body has certainly changed, but I'm the same. The consciousness, the conscious soul, the jivatma, called the dehina, what is inside the body, you see. So that continues completely as we go. You know, 40, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, and out. That's the transmigration, and we all know we're somewhere along that continuum. What happens at that final moment of death? It's not obliteration. It's not annihilation. That's Krishna's point. You get another body. Round and around and around you go. So this is immediately brings the discussion to a higher level. Because, think about it. We're living our lives as if we're going to be here forever. We're making so many plans. We're making so many arrangements. We have so many relationships and attachments that are destined to be broken. All of whatever money we accumulate, whatever relationships we accumulate or engage in, they're going to be broken. As soon as we leave this body, the body stays there, and we go on, we know not where, according to our karma, according to our activities and our consciousness. So this is the... Now, suddenly, what does dharma mean? What is the welfare, not just of the body, because the body is, after all, temporary, but how to act in such a way for the eternal welfare of the soul? That makes sense. It's just like, someone's in a... we're in a situation here, and we understand that, okay, we can have a big party tonight, we can all enjoy, we can have our favorite food and whatever, but then tomorrow we're all going to be annihilated. How can you have a party tonight if you know that? Isn't it going to affect your ability to party? Yeah. You're going to be thinking, oh my God. But actually, that's what this life is all about. We're partying now. We're thinking, how can I get this pleasure? How can I avoid this pain? How can I enjoy? Maybe a little expanded. But we're all doomed. We're on execution row, whatever, death row. So the sober person, dira, takes the time between now and when we're going to leave this body and uses it in order to create a certain consciousness that means he doesn't have to come back, that there's no birth, no more entrapment in this body which keeps us anchored down to this material world, suffering, birth, old age, disease, and death. That is the science of bhakti yoga. Now, how does it relate to Arjun's fighting this battle? It means that his frame of reference has to change, and that he has that his perfection, and ours also, is very simple. It's what religion is all about, doing the will of God. Simple as that. The will of Krishna is that the fight go on. He has arranged it for a very important reason, to reinstitute Dharma in this world. He says so right in the Bhagavad Gita. Why does God come? Why does he send his representatives? Yada yada hi dharmasya glani bhavati bharata. Notice that word dharma again. Yada yada hi dharmasya glani bhavati bharata abhyutanam adharmasya tadatmanam svajamyaham. That whenever and wherever there is a rise of irreligion and religion becomes, real dharma becomes eclipsed, at that time I manifest myself. Paratranaya sadhanam vinashayata duskritam dharma sangstapanataya sambhavami yuge yuge. In order to protect the devotees, make them flourish, in order to annihilate the miscreants who are propagating and enforcing a dharma, and in order to reinstitute dharma, I appear millennium after millennium. So this is the Lord's promise. And not only does he appear periodically, but he also sends his representatives to do the same thing that he does, which is simply to spread the word, the truth, and to live the truth, and to show the example that this is actually the best way to live for our ultimate benefit. Now, in this purport, Prabhupada mentions Lord Ram. Lord Ram is not different from Krishna. We have to, get past this idea that there are many gods. There's only one. There's only one God. There can only be one supreme personality of Godhead. But God is not limited like we are. He can expand in unlimited forms. And one of those forms is Ram, Lord Ramchandra. He appeared at a different age than Krishna, a million years earlier or something. And he manifested many of Krishna's same qualities. One was invincibility, ultimately. But he took the role of more of a human-like role than Krishna did, actually. And so he had his consort Sita, who is also the goddess of fortune. The same personality expanded in Sita. And what happened was that this demon, Ravana, who was, I always think he's the source of the word ravenous, or to ravish. And he liked to, kidnap women and ravish them. And he was ravenous. He was insatiable in his desire for power and money and influence like that. But interestingly enough, he was very learned also. He had 10 heads. And he was very intelligent in the Vedas, but because of his demonic nature, he just wanted to use that knowledge for himself and self-aggrandizement. And so he kidnapped Sita by a ruse and took her away to his kingdom of Lanka, which is the present-day Sri Lanka. And there he held her captive because of some curse. He wasn't able to ravish her. And she was very faithful to Ram. She was the emblem of chastity. The dog is having his nightly kirtan. And Ram, playing the role of a human being, was distraught and didn't know what to do. How could he find this Sita? She was lost. So he enlisted the help of this monkey army. It's a very famous story, led by Sugriva and Hanuman. And eventually they went over to the kingdom and they killed Ravana and they rescued Sita. So Ram is the personification of righteousness, and Sita the personification of chastity. So these are very instructive stories and histories. And they all point to the same thing. Ram also annihilated the demons and reinstituted Dharma. And he took the throne after that exile and episode with Ravana. So it's true for every incarnation or avatar of the Lord that he reinstitutes this Dharma. So we should direct our attention toward learning about this science, It's really a science of how to live in this world successfully. We need to get beyond the platform of our psychophysical nature, which is, after all, constantly changing and really isn't us, and live on the soul platform. That's not easy. We need to be trained. And the basic principle is that if we turn our attention toward God, especially toward Krishna, the all-attractive personality of Godhead, and we try to glorify Him, serve Him, worship, surrender, we will be in our constitution. That will be our real dharma. That's called our Sanatan Dharma. And by that dharma of bhakti yoga, the yoga of love, we will find that our life is becoming very auspicious. That we are overcoming so many problems that we have, which are many of them psychological problems. You know, things that we carry forward for many, many years. But really are just in the mind. If the mind can become controlled and peaceful by the process of bhakti yoga, many of our problems will be solved. One of the nicest principles, you know, practically, is simple living and high thinking. We you know, when this modern society tries to increase your artificial needs, you know, so that you end up with a big credit card debt, which is so much anxiety, right, to try to pay it off, constantly paying it off. But really, we can live quite simply and happily if we're Krishna conscious. And it centers on this chanting of the holy name. Krishna has came not only 5,000 years ago and spoke the Bhagavad Gita, but he came 500 years ago as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the ideal devotee of Krishna, to teach us the process of chanting in this age. Again, this word dharma, yuga dharma. Yuga dharma. For each age, there is a special process that is most suitable for self-realization. In this age of truth, millions of years ago, the best means was meditation, silent meditation. In the age of Treta, the Treta Yuga it's called, which is came after, the best means was huge sacrifices, you know, of ghee and mountains of grain in this way, and the Brahmins chanting, thousands of Brahmins chanting mantras precisely. In the age of the what is called the Dwarpa Yuga, there was the best means of realization was elaborate deity worship. You know, huge temples. There's some of these temples also survive in India, especially South India. You can see these wonderful temples. But now, you know, the predators came and took away a lot of the gold and diamonds and things, you know. But in those days, you know, actual gold, diamonds, rubies, emeralds, it was very, very ornate and elaborate. But in this present age, we can't do any of that. We're certainly not qualified to sit silently for hours and hours on end and days on end meditating on the absolute truth and wrestling with the mind and drilling the respiration. We may do that for a little bit, but who can do that? You have to go to the forest. You have to go to the mountains and the jungles to be completely alone. Not practical. So what is practical in this age? The chanting of the holy name. Hare Nama, Hare Nama, Hare Nama, Eva Kevalam, Kalo Nasteva, 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 Gatiranyata. If you want to achieve the supreme goal of life in this age, when dissension and chaos abound, look at the Middle East. I've been alive for 58 years. I don't remember one moment when it was peaceful in the Middle East. It's always been this way, you know, in Vietnam, in Africa, somewhere else, you know. Riots in L.A. There's always something every day. So this is the age of Kali, the age of quarrel and dissension and war. If you want to achieve the supreme goal of life in this age, when dissension and chaos abound, there is no other way, there is no other way, there is no other way that can ever be found. But to chant Krishna's name with a stout-hearted vow, and to pray, O Lord Krishna, O friend of the poor, let my head ever unto your lotus feet bow. This is a verse from the Naradiya Purana. I had a little embellishment on it with the poem. This is non-different instruction than what Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita, to always think of me, become my devotee like that, and so forth. So we have a big crowd tonight, and so if we'll leave, we have a little time for questions. If you have to leave, you can leave. Okay. Any questions or comments on these points? Yes.
You said that we're never born and we never die.
Right.
But we keep transmigrating from body to body to body. And by our actions, we can go down into the lower species. Can we work our way back up?
You don't even have to work your way back up. It's automatic.
So you'll spend some time in like a spider's body and then you can come
back. Yeah, you'll get, you know, through the different species of spiders and you'll become a butterfly or something. You know.
Oh, you'll just work back.
Yeah. Now that's explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, by Kapila Dev. He's an incarnation of Krishna. It's a tragedy, you know, after working your way up to the human form of life to live such a sinful life that you lose the human form and get thrown down into the species and then have to, you know, automatically work your way up and eventually come back to the human form. But we don't have any conception of God giving eternal damnation. There's nothing like that. You'll be eternally in hell and that's it. No. The soul is by nature pure. The impurities are something we bring on ourselves. So we can go astray and suffer for a long time, but not for eternity. Eventually we come back again to the human form of life and get another chance. But we shouldn't take that risk. Why should we prolong the agony? You know, we should try to make a plan in this lifetime. Let's make this our last lives. You know? And the thing about Krishna consciousness, there's always another level to experience. This idea of seeing the urgency of working toward liberation in this human life. This is the basic impetus for taking up this process of self-realization. But as you progress, you know, because really, let's face it, the biggest motivation in this world, you know, we have to face this, is fear. Even if you're having, you know, no matter how good a time you're having, you know, enjoying your senses, if some danger comes, if the house starts on fire, you forget everything and run out. Fear is the big... So the impetus for liberation is fear. I fear this birth and death syndrome. I want to get out of it. We should all want to get out of it. But fear is not a very exalted motivation, is it? So that fear, as we practice Krishna consciousness, is soon forgotten. And the motivation becomes more and more one of love. Because love of Krishna, love of God. And automatically... the liberation is taken care of. And even you say, I don't care anymore. If I can simply serve you, my Lord, and be immersed in that blissful ocean of service, then even if I have to come back, it's okay. But I have to be born in a family of devotees. I have to know about, you know, I don't, the worst fear of the devotee is to be, you know, in a situation where he has to forget Krishna, where he forgets the Lord, and then he's, again, the curtain of illusion comes down, and we think with this body, we think the enjoyment of this body is the goal of life. So this is you know, as we progress. But we shouldn't lose that you know, motivation of trying to get out of this world, because we have to have a very jaundiced view of what these material pleasures are. They are actually our worst enemies. The so-called pleasures of this world are our worst enemies, because they convince us that this is somehow a place we want to stay in. It's not. It's not a place of enjoyment. It's a place of reformation. And it's meant for austerity. As it said, Lord Rishabhdev, another incarnation of Krishna, it says, Nayam deho dehabhajang niloke kashtan kamanarate vidbhujange tapo divyam puttakahe nasatvam shudye jasman brahma saukyam tvanantam. We've heard this verse before, but we may have forgotten what it means. So I'll tell you. So he says, Nayam deho deha bhaja nirloke, those who have taken a body in the human form of life. The lower species, they're unfortunate, they'll eventually go. Now he's speaking to the human beings. Should not waste their lives trying to enjoy the senses like hogs who root around in the filth. Rather, one should perform divine austerity. Find out what it means to control the senses and direct them in the proper way. So it's called tapo divyam, divine austerity. Because by that, what's the result of that austerity? Yena shudye yasmat, putrika yena shudye yasmat. That one purifies one's existence. In other words, one becomes, it's a question of just purification. And from that purification, brahma saukyam tvanantam. This is the payoff. The payoff is not liberation. The payoff is unending happiness. Brahma Saukyam. In other words, that ananda for which we're always looking for, but looking in the wrong place. So this is the key phrase. that key idea is that don't let the senses and the mind run riot. Find out how they can be engaged properly in order to sublimate these lower desires to the higher desire of pure love for Krishna. And that will be our perfection. Kind of a long answer to a short question. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Prabhu.
Yeah, saying how in chapter 2 Krishna says we're not the body, and Arjuna's fault is that he's associating with people on the other battlefields and bodily terms.
Identifying, right, yes.
Saying, oh, this is my friend, this is my teacher. It seems like almost, like in, from my conditioned state, it seems almost impossible to like negate that. You know, like for example, my mother. You know, if my mom calls on the phone, obviously I have like more affection for her than I do other people. Like what's the process of getting over that?
Yeah, the thing is, we don't neglect that. We have to. In other words, what I was trying to get across is that these relationships have to be put in the right perspective. In an extreme situation like this, you know, of the battlefield, that's another thing. In the ordinary course of life, like for instance, after the battle was over, Yudhishthira showed great respect for Dhritarashtra. Now, Dhritarashtra was the father of the whole enemy clan. But now there's no danger, you know. And he was always respectful. But the point is that he still didn't hesitate to fight against his sons and, if necessary, kill them. Because the higher meaning of the whole thing was that we have to follow Krishna's instructions. But after the battle is over, he showed the greatest respect for Dhritarashtra. So when your mother calls, I also have a mother still. Even though I'm almost 60, my mother's alive, and I call her every so often, Hare Krishna, you know? So the point is that in the higher sense, you should keep that relationship open, certainly, and give her as much Krishna consciousness as possible. The thing is, the fact that you're progressing in Krishna consciousness means that she must become at least partially Krishna conscious because of her affection for you. And that's a great boon. In the story of Prahlad and the Sringadeva and Hiranyakashipu, after Hiranyakashipu, which is another big demon, was killed by Lord Nrisingadeva, Prahlad approached Lord Nrisingadeva and offered these wonderful prayers, and then afterward, Nrisingadeva offered him any boon he wanted. Anything he wanted, he would give him. And Prahlad objected, said, I don't want any boon. You know, I'm not like a businessman. I'm worshipping you and I want something. So he refused. And the Sringadeva insisted. So I said, okay, if you want to give me a boon, then please deliver my father from suffering. Because he was such a rascal demon, you know. He was tormenting his son, trying to kill him, you know, it was horrible. But Prahlad said, you forgive him. Just forgive him, you know, remove his sins. And so the Sringadeva said, not only Hiranyakashipu, but all, you know, I think it was seven generations back and seven generations forward, they will all be relieved of all sinful reactions. So the best thing we can do for our family members, for our friends, for anyone who has any affection for us, is to become devotees and to maintain the relationship. But always realize, you know, try to understand the perspective that it's the soul that you're relating to. You know, I remember when my father died, it was almost 20 years ago now, and, you know, I was just giving her what I just gave you, the first lessons of Bhagavad Gita. Dehi no smriyatai. Basically, Dad is still alive. You know, he went up to a... And because I was his son, you know, I could be confident that, you know, he had some idea, some Krishna consciousness at the time. He wasn't a devotee, whatever. But, you know, it was very comforting for her just to understand the basics of... And she was more open to it in that extremis, you know. So, certainly we maintain those relationships, but ultimately, as we progress, we see that the ultimate thing is the soul. Our most important relationship is with the spiritual master and with Krishna. You know, that's the key. We have to see the right perspective. But these others are also there, and we can dovetail them for the benefit of those who are related to us. Okay, we better end because it's going to be a nice kirtan coming. Thank you very much. All glories to the Prabhupada. Hari Hari Prabhupada.